by Brian Tovitz, May 21st, Tanya.
Yeah, we're learning basically Perek Lamed Gimel, Perek Lamed Daled. This is part of Likutei Amorim. This is where the Baal HaTanya just went, talks about the idea of simultaneous sadness at a person's distance from Hashem, but also the joy that there is within his personality, the godly soul, that is the Chelek Elokam Mimal, and that godly soul is never tainted, it is never besmirched, it is imprisoned, it is covered up, it is sometimes subordinated to the animal impulses within a person, but the holiness of the Nefesh Elokitz is never affected. And as a result, a person always has, definitionally, a tremendous closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we recognize Ein Od Milvado, that there is no reality in the universe other than the Ribono Shel Olam, and I am connected to the Ribono Shel Olam, that gives a person a great sense of simcha. And it is the will of Hashem, as it were, that we go through this struggle. And when I am engaged in this struggle and I try to liberate my Nefesh Elokis, I have the joy, number one, of liberating my godly soul, and number two, I have the extra joy of doing the exact reason why Hashem put me in the world.
Can I ask you, that last chapter, I think you talked about the atzfus could be used beneficially by turning it around and see how far I am from God. And,
right.
But he doesn't really tell you how to do it, the mindset. It is, if someone is sad because it's business affair or because...
So he says, turn it to God. He says, you know, if you're sad anyway...
But how can you do that?
Practically
speaking, it's a nice theory.
Well, the Baal HaTanya seems to go with the assumption that a person's mind can have a tremendous amount of control on their emotions, on their feelings, on the direction of where their emotions or feelings go. Now, we are perhaps not used to that, but the truth of the matter is, even pop psychology books, self-help books, the whole genre, which is the most popular, diet and self-help are the most popular books that are sold, and all of them talk about the fact that we have a certain mastery over the way we approach the world. We can choose to be a certain way, we can choose another way. And this is not only in the behavioral realm, this is in the psychological realm, this is in the perception realm, this is in the emotional realm, and this is what the Baal HaTanya is presupposing, that when the chokhmah of a person, the chokhmah, bina, and das, control the emotions, so the emotions can be directed in wherever you want it to go.
In a rational way only.
In a rational way. Well, this is what he's saying. He says you direct your feelings and your thoughts. It's something we're not necessarily that used to, but apparently it is something that is the master, the self-mastery of a person.
How far you are from God and all that.
Right.
Thinking, practically speaking, how do you do this?
Right. Now, in Perek Lamed Daled, basically the whole section that comes down, because one thing about the Tanya that is makes it very, very difficult is it is absolutely the case that the Prakim are very rarely self-contained units. So you think, okay, I'm just going to learn, a Perek today. Unfortunately, he'll often stop a Perek in the middle of it, almost the middle of a sentence, and then go on. So when you try to look for a unit of thoughts, it's extremely difficult. Sometimes it could be 10 prakim as a unit of thought, in which there'll be a lot of digressions, etc. But a perek, unfortunately, is not... Once in a while, Perek Lamed Beis, which talked about Avas Yisrael, was actually a very clean, self-contained unit. But I am warning you that prakim, by and large, are not self-contained units, so it's difficult. They often end in the middle of a thought. But in this particular section, which goes on for a few prakim, basically it's Lamed Dalet to Mem, so it's a very, very, very big section. He talks about the notion of elevating the physical, sanctifying the material. And here his starting point is the famous Chazal, which many Lubavitchers quote as the Baal HaTanya's own statement, but he gets it from a Medrash, that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Misaveh L'dirasei b'tachtainim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a yearning, has a taiva, has a desire to make his dwelling place in this low world. And he talks about the fact that before the physical world was created, all there was the essence of God. And the essence of God was the total reality. God is the total reality. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted, as it were, through tzimtzum, through contraction within himself, however we understand that, to create dark corners, to create dark areas where Hashem's presence is not visible, is not apparent. And even though all of those things get their life force from Hashem, they get their life force through a series of concealments. And the term is, it's mislabesh, it gets dressed in all sorts of barriers. These barriers are called klipos. Klipos are husks. And there are actually, in Kabbalah, there are four types of klipos, although I don't have the precise definitions here. All the Bala Tanya says is that three klipos are considered to be totally ra. They are considered to be totally evil. And even though those klipos themselves get their light from God, because everything that lives, everything that exists gets its light from God, but the light is so concealed and so covered over that there's nothing that is perceptible to human experience of any good. So they get their chiyus, those things that are evil in the world, get their chiyus, get their life force from the three klipos tameos. And he gives an example that even something like macholos asuros, treif animals, get their life force via the klipos of tuma. Orla, right? Orla is the fruit of the first 3 years and the like. But then there's a fourth klipa, which he refers to quite often, called klipas noga. Noga, nun gimel hay. So noga is a mixture of light and darkness, kind of a twilight or early dawn. And klipas noga is said to be those things in the world that are neither mitzvos nor averos. And therefore, they get their life force both through the klipas of Ra and a more direct infusion of the light of God. That's klipas noga. And klipas noga is the source of the life force for the things and the activities that are permitted to a person. But if he does them for his physical gratification, they become Ra. And if he does them to serve Hashem properly, eating, drinking, whatever it would be, they become tov. And therefore, klipas noga, literally, it's almost like a neon sign that sometimes it is a direct channeler for the light of Hashem, and sometimes it obscures the light of Hashem, depending on the person. Now, what the Bala Tanya says is the following. As a human being is engaged in the notion of struggle between the animal soul and the human soul, he is also dictating on a moment-by-moment basis where his life force is coming. That when I get engaged in either averos, my life force is coming through the klipas tameos. When I engage in yonim of reshus, of optional things, but I don't do so to serve Hashem, I do so for my own selfish reasons, it's klipas noga. And then there are times in which my life force comes directly from the or of Hashem, via what's called the Or Ein Sof, right, the light of the infinite one, because what I've done is I've taken the faculty of my soul and I've enveloped it in what is called the concretization of God's pure will. Now, again, this is very abstract, but the concept is, since God is a, and this is actually an argument taken from the Rambam, since God is a total unity, God is not made up of parts. So, therefore, God's will and God's essence are one and the same. See, a human being has parts. I exist. Then I have things like will, desire, thoughts. But the will, desire, thoughts are aspects of my personality, but they are apart from my essential living force. But the Rambam writes that because God is indivisible, every faculty of God must be identical to God's total essence. Therefore, God's will is in fact God's essence. And since the Torah is a concretization of God's will, when I study the Torah and I connect myself to God's will, I am connected to God's essence. And therefore, with the way the Bala Tanya writes, again, in a very elaborate, intricate, nuanced way, he says that when you take your physical body and your physical capacities, the animal soul, and what happens is, and you do mitzvahs and learn Torah with them, what happens is the will of Hashem, which is the essence of Hashem, becomes nislabesh. It becomes dressed, as it were, in the garments of your animal soul. At that moment, the animal soul itself is getting its spiritual life directly from the Or Ein Sof. Which means it's not just the godly soul that becomes directly godly, but the animal soul itself, as it gets nislabesh, as it gets enveloped in the physical. So ultimately what is happening is that it's not merely the struggle between the animal and the physical that's going on, but the animal soul itself gets raised through a process of korva to Hashem. Again, this is a very, very, the bottom line is relatively simple. In other words, you're purifying yourself by doing mitzvahs. I mean, that is the bottom line of all of this. But the particular intricate manner of expression is that the chiyus, the life force of the animal soul, comes directly from the Hiskalos, from the revelation of the Or Ein Sof, the light of the infinite, when you link the animal soul to the will of God, which is concretized in the Torah, because that will is coextensive to the essence of God, because God is indivisible. I'm not sure if I mentioned that. Now, the Rambam uses this, actually. The Rambam uses this for a very different purpose. The Rambam never speaks this way. I mean, the Rambam will say, you know, mitzvahs perfect the soul. That's as far as the Rambam goes with this idea. But this notion that you can't separate God's will and God's knowledge. Right. He says the Rambam uses it to answer another question, which the Baal Tanya is not interested in even discussing here, and that is the contradiction between free will and God's knowledge of the future. That's a very, very famous question. Right, Hashem knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. He knows what I'm going to do 10 years from now. In what sense do I have free will? So the attempt that the Rambam answers is, the Rambam's answer actually is not that much of an answer. The Rambam says it's not an answer. The Rambam wants to show that logically the question cannot be answered. And the reason why it's logically impossible to answer is that if God's knowledge and God's essence are one and the same, and we accept that we cannot understand God's essence, then we can't understand God's knowledge, because if I understood God's knowledge, I would know God's essence, because God's knowledge and God's essence are the same. And therefore, since it's axiomatic that God's essence cannot be perceived, therefore God's knowledge cannot be perceived. So the Ravid, the famous critic of the Rambam, was very annoyed with this. He writes there that if the Rambam could not answer the question, he shouldn't have asked it to begin with, because it confuses people and it gives them doubts in emunah, and it's better not to ask the question at all. The Ravid himself gives an answer, which is also a big chiddush. He says, God's knowledge is in the nature of perfect prediction, meaning to say, just like, you know, your mother is likely, that's it. You have a choice if you want to eat vanilla ice cream or chocolate ice cream or whatever it is, Cheerios or cornflakes. But, you know, your mother or your spouse would be able to know based on prediction. Now, human prediction is imperfect. God's prediction is perfect, but just as prediction does not force choice, so even divine prediction does not force choice. Sure. It is simply God knowing what you will choose, but the choice is still up to you, and God is functioning as a predictor. That's what the Ravid says. Others say it a little differently. They say that the issue of how does foreknowledge interfere with choice is only an issue when you live in the realm of time. Right. Because if the future hasn't happened yet, and I know what you're gonna do, you don't have the choice. But if one is above time, and one is seeing everything from the vantage point of the concurrent moment, so the same way if I see you doing something, it's just I see you doing it. I didn't have an input in making you do it. So for God, the infinite future is essentially the present present moment. So there are different answers. But this notion that God's essence and God's knowledge are one and the same, the Rambam uses it to answer this idea of free will versus foreknowledge versus omniscience. The Bala Tanya uses it in a different way. He uses it for the idea that the animal soul gets its chiyus from the light of Hashem, because the animal soul, as it were, becomes a garment for the will of Hashem as concretized in the Torah. And that is why we do mitzvos, so our physical bodies become concretized into the will of Hashem. That is why we speak words of Torah and tefillah, so the koach adibor, and that is why our thoughts think about Torah and the like, because we are connecting ourselves to the essence of Hashem. The metzias of Hashem is nislabesh. It is dressed, as it were, in the garments of our physical bodies.
Where does the animal soul draw its nourishment?
The animal soul gets its life force from the klipas noga. That's what it says, the klipas noga. Now again, ultimately, everything does come from God. But the question is, it comes to God through these intermediate limiting forces. But you have that power too. So basically the idea is like this. So in a sense, and he'll try to reconcile this, in a sense, therefore, there's kind of an inconsistency in how this process is being described. On one level, it was described as kind of animal soul pulling you down and godly soul pulling you in the right way. You got these two forces. But then there's this notion that the animal soul itself can become elevated and refined. Now perhaps, he doesn't say exactly at this point, perhaps this is referring to the Beinoni taking the journey towards being a tzaddik. Perhaps that's what he's talking about. Because the way the Bala Tanya describes the Beinoni is always having this struggle between the animal soul that's pulling him. But now he's switching focus a little bit to emphasize the fact that the animal soul itself becomes elevated with these choices. Now that doesn't mean you've totally purified it of its connection to Klipas Noga, but you're getting it more and more independent of that. And I guess the ultimate culmination would be tzaddik, although Bala Tanya does emphasize that the Beinoni cannot really hope. In other words, every person, because of free will, can hope to defeat the animal soul. That is God's guaranteed promise to us. But to vanquish its ra, that he says, that may not be. That's me'ein olam haba, and that may not be given to everybody. And the Bala Tanya's whole point is, if you don't reach that madrega, don't feel bad about it. Because that's not necessary.
You can't reach that madrega, otherwise you wouldn't have
the chirum. Yeah, he says you might not be able to reach that madrega, he says.
You can't.
Well, he doesn't say you can't, because he says there are people who do.
Who have a chirum in this world?
That was the question. As I say, I mentioned that according to Chabad legend, the Alter Rebbe wrote, and after he wrote the Kutei Amarim, which is called the Sefer of Beinonim, he wrote another Sefer called Sefer Shel Tzadikim, which was designed to answer the question, what is the role of a tzaddik in the world, since the tzaddik no longer has to struggle against the evil? So he actually wrote a Sefer Shel Tzadikim. That Sefer is reputed to have been destroyed. So we don't have the answer. Apparently, there is some function there. But the function would not be the idea of that type of struggle.
Is a hislamshus a phenomenon that changes from second to second? So you learn Torah, you're mislabish, and then you take a break, you play basketball, and you lose hislamshus, you get it back again. It's like a current that just ebbs and goes.
The way it's described here is it is described as something literally, moment by moment. But there is a concept called rishimo, which means to say that the totality of one's experiences makes a roshan. And that roshan kind of stays even afterwards. And that's both for good and for bad. Meaning there's a roshan of Kedusha, a roshan of Tuma, and those rishimas are also realities. It's like just like a car can run on fumes for a while. So there are fumes of these life forces that remain. And therefore, even if one learns Torah this moment, there may still be many, many negative connections. And vice versa as well. So this is one of the main ideas of Hasidus generally, That is the notion of elevating the physical. Now, in the very early decades of Chassidus, even before the Baal HaTanya wrote, this was sometimes taken to a very very dangerous and improper level. In fact, the Vilna Gaon, when he excommunicated the early Chassidim, talked about, you know, people getting drunk and people doing other things with the notion that we're elevating the physical. And again, that's why the Baal HaTanya writes over and over again, you elevate the physical when you engage in physical activities in order to learn better, to daven better, to do mitzvahs, to give tzedakah. When you engage in physical activities for your own physical pleasures and the like, you're still being connected to Klipas Noga and everything else. But this notion of sanctifying the physical is a very, very fundamental idea, and the Baal HaTanya comes back to it again and again. In fact, in his Shulchan Aruch, you know, the Baal HaTanya wrote the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, a very, very well-regarded Sefer Halacha. The Mishnah Berurah quotes it a lot. It's not limited to Lubavitch in any way. Also, stylistically, it's a very, 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 very fine work. He really explains the foundations of Halacha in a very, very clear way. So I'll tell you a thought that he says, a very fascinating thought that he says in the Shulchan Aruch on Hilchos Shavuos, which really ties into this idea that we can take the physical things of the world and we connect them to Hashem. Because by using them for the Torah becomes the Slabesh in them, which is the Ratzon Hashem. And therefore they themselves become elevated. The Shulchan Aruch Paskins like this. The Shulchan Aruch Paskins that the day after Shavuos, you do not say Tachanun. Now, our minhag is we don't say it for a week because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if you didn't bring the Korban Re'iyah, the pilgrimage offering, on the first day of Shavuos, you had six more days to bring it, even though it's not a Yom Tov. So our minhag is we don't say Tachanun for all those days. But what the Shulchan Aruch says, Me'ikar Hadin, the only day that you don't say Tachanun is the day after Shavuos. And the reason the Shulchan Aruch gives is because the day after Shavuos is the day that we call the Yom Tavoach, the day of the slaughter. What does that mean? Because Shavuos is unique. It's in Eretz Yisrael, it's only a one-day Yom Tov, right? It's a one-day Yom Tov. So most people did not bring their Olas Re'iyah, their pilgrimage burnt offering on Shavuos. They brought it the day after Shavuos, which was a Chol. And therefore, since that was the day that most people brought their Olas Re'iyah, their pilgrimage burnt offering, so it's like a chag, we don't say Tachanun. So the Rav Shulchan Aruch asks a very very good question. It's a bit of a technical question, but it's a very strong question. That is, wait a second here. Why should I say that the day after Shavuos is Yom Tavoach? Why would most people bring their offering the day after Shavuos? Now, in reality, there is a machlokas, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Can you bring an Olas Re'iyah on Yom Tov? For example, Pesach, you'd have to bring it Cholamot. Beis Shammai says, an Olas Re'iyah can never be brought on Yom Tov. And Beis Shammai's argument is that the only heter for slaughtering and burning meat on Yom Tov is only for human consumption. And since an Ola is something that's totally burnt for Hashem, so Beis Shammai says you can't do it on Yom Tov. It's violating Yom Tov. So according to Beis Shammai, the Olas Re'iyah of Pesach would have to be brought Chol HaMoed. The Olas Re'iyah of Sukkot would have to be brought Chol HaMoed. The Olas Re'iyah of Shavuos would have to be brought the next day. So like Beis Shammai, there's a concept of Yom Tavoach. But Beis Hillel argues with Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel says Beferish, that although you can't bring an Olas Re'iyah on Shabbos, that's true, but on Yom Tov, because he says that we include, that even though the Torah says Lachem for you, but we also include things that are given to Hashem, like Korban Ola, we only exclude cooking for animals or cooking for Goyim and the like. So according to Beis Hillel, there is nothing wrong with bringing an Olas Re'iyah on Shavuos itself. Now, since in any machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the halacha is always like Beis Hillel, so why would the day after Shavuos have the chashivas of Yom Tavoach? Now, if you're going to say, well, okay, but if you didn't bring it, you have a chance the next day. Well, so what? That would justify the whole week, which is exactly our minhag. But the Shulchan Aruch is saying there's something special about the day after. What would be special? It's only special like Beis Shammai. It is not special like Beis Hillel. By the way, just a little bit of a clarification. When I said that according to Beis Shammai, you're not allowed to bring a burnt offering on Yom Tov because it's not for human consumption, that is only true for private burnt offerings. Now, the pilgrimage offering is a private offering that people have to bring. The musafim, right? Every Yom Tov had a musaf, which was a communal offering. The communal offerings are brought not only on Yom Tov, they're even brought on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. So the musafim that are burnt offerings, that are communal offerings, that certainly can be done on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Beis Shammai's point is, however, that the pilgrimage offering is a private korban that each family or an individual has to bring. That, he says, you cannot bring an ola on Yom Tov. So actually, I'm sorry, I misspoke. The question that was asked is the Magen Avraham asked the question. The Magen Avraham asked the question, why is there a Yom Tavoach here, the day of slaughter, that's only like Beis Shammai, that is not like Beis Hillel? Right? This is the Magen Avraham's question. So the Magen Avraham gives an answer that even though the halacha is like Beis Hillel, but the minhag of Klal Yisrael in the time of the Beis HaMikdash was to follow Beis Shammai on this one. This is what the Magen Avraham says, Nagu ha'am kedivrei Beis Shammai, and that's why there's a concept of Yom Tavoach. This is what the Magen Avraham says. So the Emes says, the Rav Shulchan Aruch says, I mean, l'chayre, very, very difficult to understand this. Why would they follow Beis Shammai on this matter? And we find in a number of places that Chazal were actually very condemning of people who would follow Beis Shammai, even when Beis Shammai is saying something that according to Beis Hillel wouldn't have be a problem. For example, remember the Mishnah in Brachos where Beis Shammai says, the way you read the Shema in the morning, you got to read standing up, and Kumecha, in the evening you have to read lying down. And Beis Hillel says, no, the Torah just means you read Shema at the time people wake up, and you read Shema at the time that people go to sleep. So Rabbi Tarfon says, one time I was on the road, and I lay down on the ground to read the Shema like Beis Shammai, because I wanted to be strict. And what happened was the robbers came, they almost killed me. So he was trying to get some emotional support there, and the answer they told him was, you deserve to die. You don't follow Beis Hillel. He says, what do you expect? You know, Hashem shouldn't even protect you.
Does the klal of Mito not apply to Mili Nishmaya? You can't say for an Olam Mitoch Shorter.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why Beis Hillel doesn't say Mitoch? But Beis Hillel has a drasha that it says Lachem, Hu Levado Yeyasa Lachem, and Lachem excludes Gavoa. So the principle of Mitoch can tell me it doesn't have to be for cooking, it can be for other needs, but the other needs have to be lachem needs. And therefore, you don't say mitoch on the category of needs that the Torah says are not legitimate. Just like, for example, you can't say mitoch in cooking for a goy or cooking for an animal. I can't say that because that's not the needs for which you say mitoch. Where you do have a kasha, though, okay, I don't want to give a shir nochas yom, but if you do have a kasha, then according to Rashi's view of mitoch, that you don't need a tzarech at all. The question is, if you don't need any tzarech, then what's wrong with this tzarech? But at least according to Taisus and the other, and most Rishonim, you need a tzarech kitzas, so the Torah is telling me that certain things are not so.
According
to Rashi, you can't, but it's a question on Rashi. Rashi doesn't differ with the halacha, but there is a question on Rashi. If you don't need any tzarech at all, then why is a tzarech of a guy worse than a zero? Apparently it is, but the question is logically, why would it be? And it's even okay. So. Well, for a guy, but on the other hand, but then you're saying it's Sarach Gavoa and Ola, according to that's going to be a harder one. So here's the thing. So the question is really on the Magen Avraham, why would there all of a sudden be a minhag on Shavuos specifically to follow the Shita of Beis Shammai? Moreover, there's no indication in the Magen Avraham that they followed Beis Shammai's position on Pesach or Sukkot. Remember, according to Beis Shammai, on Pesach as well, you'd have to defer the Ola to Chol HaMoed. Doesn't say they did that. They brought it on the first day, unless they couldn't do it and they took advantage of the week. So why would they only follow Beis Shammai for the holiday of Shavuos? So the explanation that's given is really exactly connected to what the Tanya says here. And that is, The idea of Matan Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a way in which his essence is concretized in his will. And by linking the physical world to his will becomes nislabesh in these physical things. And therefore, the Or Ein Sof, the godly light, enlightens and gives life to all of these things. So the whole very purpose of the Torah is to teach us how we can sanctify even that which is physical, even that which is removed from God. The whole purpose is to teach us that holiness does not mean to renounce and to reject the physical, but to take the physical and elevate it and sanctify it. So here is the thing. If you look at korbanos, the ola represents the korban that is totally given over to God. It is totally burnt. The kohanim do not have any share in the meat. They have the hide, but the hide is not part of the korban per se. So the ola represents a model of holiness that is predicated on renunciation, asceticism. The idea that God cannot be served by our indulgence in the animal aspects of our being. God can only be served by renouncing the animal aspects of our being, by not eating, by not drinking, by giving it over totally to Hashem. But if the essence of the Torah is to teach us that even the physical and animal parts of ourselves and parts of our existence can be elevated and consecrated, then one can understand why there was a minhag not to emphasize the ola on Shavuos. In other words, Shavuos, we emphasize the shlamim, we emphasize the physical aspects of eating and drinking, and the renunciation we leave for another day. Now again, did this go through everybody's thought? I mean, obviously, the average person who was simply told, our custom is we bring the korban the day after Shavuos, didn't necessarily have such a deep philosophical idea, but the Baal HaTanya suggests, not here, in the Kutei Torah, he suggests that this was kind of the instinct, the subconscious instinct of the Jewish people was that the Ola was not the appropriate offering for Shavuos, because Shavuos is about integrating and elevating the physical and not creating a holiness based on renunciation. Now again, I mean, L'charia, you could still ask a few questions here, because Shavuos is not an Ola-free day. You still had the Korban Tamid, which was Olos. Most of the Musafim, virtually all of them were Olos. I mean, so you had Olos, but at least this particular concept of the individual not bringing his Ola, that was Nagu Ha'am Kebei Shammai. According to Beis Hillel, it's halachically permitted. So we certainly don't follow Beis Shammai's view that it's prohibited to bring the Ola. But we recognize that Ola is a model of Kedusha that the Torah is teaching me I can go beyond. In other words, Ola posits the inevitable conflict between the animal and the spiritual. The Shlamim represents the notion that the animal part of me can be elevated as well. And that is the triumph of Matan Torah.
And Matan Torah itself, it says
they ate and they drank. Yeah. Although there's
a support the view that,
right.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Although again, Rashi himself learns that the eating and drinking referred to gazing at the Shekhinah. But it's interesting that there is a Gemara that makes this point explicitly. There is a general machlokas in the Gemara between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. How do you celebrate Yom Tov? Because one pasuk says Yom Tov is for Hashem, and another pasuk says Yom Tov is lachem. The Yom Tov is for you. Is it for God or for you? So we have a machlokas. Rabbi Eliezer says, every person makes their own choice. You can either make Yom Tov primarily, now again, I say primarily, the Gemara does not mean totally for you. I mean, you got to daven, you got to say Kriya Shema. But it means that one could choose to make Yom Tov primarily and predominantly for the pleasures of the body. You can eat and spend most of the day eating and drinking and sleeping. Or, if you so choose, Rabbi Eliezer's position is, you can devote the day totally to Hashem's worship. And according to Rabbi Eliezer, other than the first night of Pesach and the first night of Sukkot, you do not have to have a meal on Yom Tov. According to Rabbi Eliezer, you are allowed to fast on Yom Tov if you want to devote yourself kulo l'Hashem. This is what Rabbi Eliezer says. Rabbi Yoshua, which we paskin like, says no. The way you reconcile the pasuk is not either or, but you got to have both, and therefore Yom Tov must be divided between Chatzi l'Hashem and Chatzi l'Hashem.